Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Open for Questions on the role of science, technology, and innovation in promoting global development. My name is Karen Richardson with the White House Office of Public Engagement, and with me I have Tom Khalil, who is Deputy Director for Policy at the Office of Science and Technology, Gail Smith, who is Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Democracy and Development at the National Security Staff, and of course we have Dr. Raj Shah, who is the Administrator over at the U.S. Agency for Development, international development. Welcome, we will be taking your questions live on Twitter at the hashtag WHChat, and you can also watch this live on whitehouse.gov/live. So we're gonna get directly into questions. And again, I will be taking questions live on Twitter as well. So the first question will be for Dr. Shah, and this question is from Samantha, who asks, why is innovation important for USAID to do now, given this budget climate in particular?
Well, thank you, Karen. You know, the answer from our perspective is that innovations in development bring the cost down of achieving results. So when we saw today that you could use mobile phones to take photographs of an election process in Afghanistan and reduce corruption and fraud significantly, the alternative is not reducing corruption and fraud or spending a lot more money on a much more elaborate process to accomplish that same result. And what was wonderful about the event that Gail and Tom just hosted was we saw so many different examples where new science, new technology basically makes it cheaper and more possible to make the world a better place. And that's why we're launching this partnership today with a series of American universities. And you can go to usaid.gov to learn more about it, but we invite universities to partner with us more actively because we know students on campus, faculty, researchers have great ideas and great innovations that they could bring to this administration's development goals and development policy, and we'd love to work with you.
Great. The next question is from Neoma, who asks, in which areas of development is innovation most urgently needed?
All of the above. I think what we're finding, and I think it kind of goes with the territory of innovation, is that USAID and our other agencies are applying it across all sectors. I think the two that, the three actually, in terms of the President's priorities on development, are food security, where we've seen terrific progress. Dr. Shah mentioned this at the event, global health, where aid did its first grand challenge, and in the area of climate change. So I think my trick answer would be all of the above.
Okay, this question is from Sally, who asked, Dr. Shah, could you please describe the role scientific innovation will play in Feed the Future, the State Department's Global Food Security Initiative? Examples would be helpful.
Sure. Well, Gail was just talking about agricultural development. Feed the Future is the Obama administration's effort to address the chronic problem of food insecurity and hunger around the world. There's still more than 900 million people that go to bed hungry every night, the majority of whom are kids. And the reality is we can invest in new crops, in new farming systems that will improve production around the world. One specific example that I just saw yesterday came out of Bangladesh was we've invested in stress-tolerant rices, actually rices that grow in saltier waters. And we've seen big production improvements from using that new form of rice in certain parts of Bangladesh that have chronically been low-producing areas where they've needed food aid and assistance. Now they're having bumper crops, and they're able to actually send surplus food outside of those communities to the rest of the country. That's really what success can look like there and around the world. And there are a wonderful range of examples. Gail sometimes refers to me as Mr. Sweet Potato Head for talking about vitamin-enriched sweet potatoes that help children avoid river blindness and other problems that come with vitamin A deficiency. But the range of what's possible because of the science is really extraordinary in the area of agriculture and food. And that's why we're partnering with the U.S. Department of Agriculture and other scientific agencies to really help support scientists around the world to do that.
We're also seeing some really interesting startup companies who have some breakthrough ideas. One in particular is looking at the question about whether you could use biotechnology to produce high-quality nutrients directly from sunlight. So the idea is that you would be able to increase the density of the production of protein and other essential nutrients by a factor of 300 compared to soy. So typically we talk about productivity increases of 1 or 2% in the agriculture sector, and by redefining the problem, we may have an opportunity for a real breakthrough here.
Okay, great. The next question is really directed towards the youth community. How can we best involve youth in the innovation conversation?
Well, this is another chance to talk about our emerging portfolio with universities. You know, the reality is the president just hosted the science fair yesterday here at the White House, and we saw some amazing examples today of what students, whether they're in high school, college, or graduate school, are doing around our country to help address some of the solvable problems of our time. The challenge of eliminating HIV/AIDS, the aspiration to reduce child death, the opportunity to reduce hunger and extreme poverty around the world. And in all of those cases, we can see student groups in particular come together with new ideas, with new technologies, with new ways of solving problems. And that's really why we've launched this university's partnership program today. And it's why we hope that universities, especially those with students that care about development, that care about these issues, and that have an interest in participating with USAID, the US government, but also just with partner communities and partner universities around the world, we want to be a platform to help support that interest and engage students in those types of efforts. And so please do look at our site today and explore whether your university could apply to be an institutional partner with us in this mission.
Okay, great. The next question is from Joe Mason, who asks, how can faith-based organizations with congregations in Africa be used as training facilities for the latest in development technology? And I suppose that you could sort of maybe speak to a little bit more broadly in terms of the role that faith-based organizations can play in this effort.
Well, I'll start, but then I'll ask Gail to add to this. I'll offer just one example. We had Kay Warren of Saddleback Church and seeing both Gail and I quite recently. And her congregation has sent more than 14,000 people abroad on development and health-oriented missions. In Rwanda, they're training something like 3,500 community health workers to distribute bed nets for malaria, to do testing and referral for HIV/AIDS, and to help improve sanitation conditions and public health access in those environments. And it's making a big, big difference. What we think those types of engagements are the types we'd like to support. And if there are congregations and communities of faith around the world that want to be part of this development mission, we already know if you are poor and you live in the slum in Kibera outside of Nairobi, you're most likely going to get your health care and your education from institutions of faith. And we recognize that. We want to partner more with faith-based institutions, and we want to encourage the kind of community-to-community connections that can really be very, very powerful and very important.
I would just add to that that I think there's something about networks in the sense of community itself that can be a force multiplier in this. So, for example, Raj mentioned the idea of bed nets. There are a lot of cases in Africa where, through churches or other religious institutions, people have simply provided the simple information about how to use bed nets. Then all of those congregants go home, if they can get a bed net, which an increasing number can today, they know how to use it. So that's, I think, one critical piece. I think another is on helping spread the word about some of these new innovations. One of the things that was really driven home in the event we just came from is how many new things are happening all the time and how many ideas there are out there. How do you get the word out? And to the extent that people can use community centers, faith-based institutions, as Raj pointed out, universities, schools, as places to share the basic information that these techniques and technologies are available, it's another way that helps us get to scale.
Great, and I think from Frank Dossa asked what the role that diaspora communities could also play in this effort.
I think it's enormous, and working with diaspora communities has been a big priority for this administration and the president. One of the ways, and some of the examples we've seen, is innovations and technologies that have been developed here and then taken back to home countries by members of the diaspora. The other is helping innovators who may develop a technology or a product, but it may not be refined to adapt to a particular country's circumstances or culture. Again, working with the diaspora community to do that. So I think there are a huge number of ways. I think we've also seen that some of the innovations that have terrific impact are those that come from diaspora communities who may be going to a university in the United States, maybe a resident or a citizen of the United States, but nonetheless are thinking about how can I apply what I'm learning and inventing here.
You can also have members of the diaspora who have technical skills in a particular area. So you may have diaspora who are doctors and nurses, yep, and using the power of information and communications technologies are able to provide the benefits of their skills and expertise to their colleagues from the country that they were originally working in.
That's absolutely right.
Absolutely. Our next question will come from MCHIP. And we've talked a lot about the role that U.S. universities can play. Their question is, how do we best involve non-U.S. universities in the new engagement initiative to get locally driven solutions?
That's a great question, and I think there are a couple things. There's the peer program that was referenced. You may want to say more about that, Tom, but there are partnerships that have been created, particularly through the National Institute for Health, to link to institutions of learning around the world. USAID has a development innovation ventures fund that provides grants to activities. We saw a couple of examples, one from India and I think one from Kenya, that are actually providing, if you will, the seed capital for somebody to take an idea and really test run it at a larger scale. The other way that I think has proven quite effective, and it's something the U.S. government hadn't really made it much of our business to do, is the Grand Challenge that AID has done in global health and now education. Tom's been involved with others across other sectors, but that's been one that has solicited ideas from all around the world. I think Raj mentioned that in one of them there were ideas submitted from 70 countries. So again, as Tom suggests, using the power of information technology, what we are trying to do is open up this space in our partnerships as broadly as we can around the world and use that technology to link everyone together.
I think another very powerful tool is twinning. That is, you know, in the same way that we have sister city relationships, mm-hmm, to have strong relationships between U.S. universities and developing country universities. The developing country universities can help provide some more context on the nature of the problem. And by doing these things jointly, with rather than for, that can have a much longer impact. USDA is also developing some scholarship programs. You know, one of the problems is in the area of agricultural research, we need to have more developing country researchers, and I think scholarships are another very effective way of building up the research workforce in developing country universities.
Great, and I think that you know, we will turn over, there's a question specifically on global health. So can innovations only improve maternal health, or is there a need for integration of strategies?
Yeah, there are a number of innovations that people are looking at. The one that Raj Shah mentioned in the workshop that we had is the Saving Lives at Birth, which is looking at opportunities to harness innovation for both reducing maternal mortality, but also newborn mortality as well. And there are all sorts of innovations, whether it's new drugs that are capable of reducing postpartum hemorrhage, which is one of the major causes of maternal mortality.
Okay. Another question is, how can development partners support homegrown innovation in developing countries?
I think if it's individuals, there are a lot of foundations, non-governmental institutions and organizations in this country that are supporting innovators. There's also, again, the power of the internet, the ability of some of those innovators to be immediately accessible. So the first is kind of direct support. I think the second is to support the kinds of things that we in the private sector and universities are trying to do, which is build the institutional framework in the United States to have those pipelines so that we as a country can lend more deliberate and consistent support to those innovators. A third way, and I think this is really of high value, I said at the close of the session we just came from that anybody who left that session and wasn't quite excited about the possibility was not breathing.
Fired up and ready to go.
Fired up and ready to go. And I think that the key thing is there are innovators in each of our communities. There are students at all of our universities who have stories to tell, like we heard this morning, like the president heard yesterday at the science fair. Supporting them and getting the word out, giving them platforms to share their ideas, I think is the way some of these innovations are built upon and can get to scale. So I think providing those platforms is also key.
Okay, and so Mary DeLuca asks, what are the global plans to help the rural parts of the world? So are there any specific initiatives in any of the announcements that we made today that are really directed towards helping the more rural parts of the world with this?
Yeah, so absolutely. So USDA made a number of announcements that are related to increasing the impact of the research that USDA funds by partnering with a number of companies and NGOs to increase access to that information. And that's certainly something that has the potential to increase agricultural productivity. They also have an initiative that they're calling the Plant Doctor, where you might be able to use mobile technology so that farmers in rural parts of the country have access to the latest information about how to increase productivity.
And I think we saw a couple of other examples. One of the things discussed this morning was mobile banking. And there are a lot of smallholder farmers and people living in rural areas around the world that do not have access to banking systems, which constrains a whole number of things. If you want to buy something to improve your productivity and you don't have a banking facility, that poses all sorts of constraints. Mobile banking makes it possible for people for whom it would otherwise be impossible to have a bank account to have one. There are more people in Kenya today who have access to banking through mobile facilities than through a regular checking account. And that has a huge impact on rural farmers. We also had a great example from Kickstart, which is an organization Tom and I have known for some time, which developed has developed a pump, a water pump that is low-tech, high-impact, affordable, in which they're working at getting to scale, and is the kind of thing that's transformative for a small farming family in a rural area.
And it's called the super money maker because it allows a poor rural farmer to make more money by irrigating with a very low-cost device, 2 acres, and being able to grow multiple crops and generate additional income and reduce poverty.
Okay, great. And so the next question is from Facebook, Michael Norton. How will America lead in the internet age? And I think you guys can also address the question about how to harness, because you discussed it earlier this morning, about how you harness the internet and technology to promote global development.
Well, I mean, I just think there are a huge number of opportunities. We've already talked about mobile banking. Online learning is another major possibility. I told the story of a Stanford professor who is teaching an artificial intelligence course that was taken by over 100,000 people from all over the world. The internet is allowing rural farmers to find out what the price of their crops is and increase the price that they get because they can know when they're being taken advantage of by a middleman. We saw examples of mobile and internet technology being used to improve the fairness of elections. So I just think there are a huge number of opportunities to leverage information and communications technologies.
Karen, if I could add one thing to that, I think it's modernizing something we've been good at for a long time. I remember a discussion we had here some time back talking about the global HIV/AIDS crisis and the fact that throughout the developing world there are some real superstars that are arising, local healthcare workers, ministers of health. And one of our colleagues from NIH pointed out that several of those we were discussing were actually trained in the U.S., were brought here on the kind of scholarships that you mentioned that USDA is now going to start doing, or had research grants. And I think what we have a huge capacity for is these institutions of research and development, we're doing more of that, that helps us build the capacity of our partners and grow more innovation leaders, if you will, as Tom suggested, but then also modernizing that. So this plant doctor idea, rather than doing what one used to do, which is have expensive conferences and people would fly in all over and you'd have big hunks of paper, we're figuring out how to use the internet to make that the outcomes of those research be immediately available and meaningful to a smallholder farmer on the other side of the world.
And to be able to do more for less. I mean,
much more cost effective.
One of the things about digital information is that the marginal cost of making it available to more people is essentially zero.
Yep.
So I guess that relates to a question we have from Research America, who asks, there have been many public-private partnerships in research and development that have been, you know, been going on for years. How is this new initiative? What makes this one unique?
Well, I think one thing is that we're not just talking about USAID, although they're clearly going to be playing a leadership role in this, but what's so encouraging is that you have the leadership of the National Science Foundation, NIH, U.S. Department of Agriculture, all identifying ways in which they can contribute to these goals. And the second thing is that we have a president who really believes in an all-hands-on-deck approach. So it's not just government trying to solve these problems on its own. It's our ability to convene and to build coalitions of not only the government agencies, but the private sector, nonprofit organizations, social enterprises, to make a big difference in these problems. And the new technology is also providing us a lot of opportunities that didn't exist even 5-10 years ago.
I would add one thing. We have a president who, as Tom says, believes in the power of innovation. He also believes in data and evidence and outcomes. And he signed something in September of 2010, the first ever presidential policy directive on global development. And in that, he directed us to put a premium on bringing innovation to bear. And there was more specificity to that. It's on the White House website if you want to look at it. But what it's actually meant is, I think, we've been able to take some enormous strengths the U.S. government has always had in this area, build on those, engage those agencies that may not have been engaged in the past, link them together, and start delivering results, I think, in greater number, with greater consistency, in such a way that we're institutionalizing a different way of doing business.
One great example of that is USAID has a program called Development Innovation Ventures. Mm-hmm. And it works in a way that is not dissimilar from the way the venture capital community works. They provide small ideas for new ideas that are worth trying. They provide medium-sized grants to validate promising approaches using rigorous evaluation so we know whether it works and whether it's cost-effective. And then once it's made it through that hurdle, then USAID is prepared to put additional funds to help scale up an idea. And that's going to increase the confidence of the American taxpayer that we're doing what works.
And it's a whole lot less costly
than
USAID underwriting the cost of our actually going in and doing whatever it is. The example we saw of expanding electricity to rural populations in India, for example.
So then would you sort of answer that question the same way? Another question is, what is the anticipated economic impact of this renewed focus on science, technology, and innovation?
Well, I think for the United States, a familiarity with the needs of emerging markets is going to be an important driver. I mean, that's why the president has set this goal of doubling U.S. exports. So to the extent that our researchers and our companies are familiar with some of the challenges that people in emerging markets face, that's going to position the United States to really be able to take advantage of the explosive growth that is occurring in these markets. We're also seeing the phenomena of reverse innovation. So an innovation occurring in a developing country and it also being relevant to U.S. needs as well. So those are some of the concrete ways in which the United States is going to be able to benefit from working on some of the challenges faced by developing countries.
I think also significant impact in terms, and this is something that Raj said at the outset, of the outcomes we're able to achieve for the taxpayer money that we invest. Now, we still live in a world where there is a mythology out there that 10-20% of our budget is spent on foreign aid.
But what is it really, Gail?
Gee, it's a whole lot less than 1%. But I think the challenge, whatever the size of that budget, we're stewards of the taxpayers' money, is to show returns on the investment. And I think we're seeing three outcomes that I would put money on as being lasting. One is that we're able to achieve greater impact for fewer dollars. The second is that we are institutionalizing that so that our entire system is changing. And third, I think we are investing in the power and creativity of our partners in the developing world. In other words, we're we're reducing dependency even in the way we're operating. And that brings us back to all the returns Tom spoke of. If we've got more stable, functioning, thriving economies with citizens who are able to participate, we've got many more partners in the world.
Great. Our next question is from Linda. You've talked about public-private partnerships on development innovations. Do you think corporate responsibility also plays a role here?
Absolutely. But what we're seeing now is something that goes beyond traditional corporate social responsibility, where a company might say, well, I'm going to take 1% of my profits or 1% of my revenue and invest it in a foundation. There's nothing wrong with that. But an even more exciting opportunity is to go after what Michael Porter has called shared value. That is, are there opportunities for companies to really engage not just the philanthropic side of the house, but the core competence of the firm? So can they develop products and services that meet the needs of developing countries? How do they leverage their supply chains in ways that are going to lift more farmers out of poverty? And so I think that we should not only be looking at traditional corporate social responsibility and philanthropy, but what Michael Porter has called shared value.
And I think we should also keep an eye on a phenomenon that I think we're beginning to see. It's too early to judge it absolutely, but in a lot of developing countries where it may have been that the private sector was constrained, and that with more and more countries undergoing elections and opening up, the private sector is now able to operate in different ways. And what we're seeing is a lot of people, particularly young people, with very innovative ideas that are about solving problems, but which they're figuring out how to make cost-effective and marketable. They're figuring out how to do it in such a way that an investor would be interested. So we're seeing the rise of a significant number of small companies that are making money, but they're making money doing good. And that sets an entirely different stage for what the private sector can be about.
So I think before we wrap up, are there any final words that you guys want to say in terms of the event this morning or anything that we just discussed here?
Well, I personally am tremendously excited about the initiative that USAID launched in terms of increasing their interaction with the universities, because I've seen firsthand at how many young people want to be able to take whatever they've learned, whether it's cutting-edge synthetic biology or engineering or the schools that they've learned in the design school or business school, and be part of solving a really important problem. How do we reduce the 9 million kids who die every year under the age of 5? How could we provide clean energy services to the most remote rural village? And I think that by doing this, we're just going to be able to tap into an incredible amount of brain power and creative thinking and idealism and creativity that I think is going to make a huge difference and help improve the human condition.
And I would just close by thanking everybody for participating, but also asking you to stay engaged. There's a theme running through all of this about innovation for development, which is about all hands on deck. And that's not just governments and universities and companies, it's also individuals. And there are a number of things each and every one of you can do as an individual. So I'd encourage you to keep an eye on all of our websites. We just put up a fact sheet this morning on the White House webpage that's got some links for you. USAID has done these grand challenges. There will be more. And I think we've got enormous opportunity across the government to work with people around the United States who want to join in what Tom described as an idealistic, but I think a very doable, workable, and worthy enterprise.
Great. I want to thank Gail and also Tom and Dr. Shaw for taking the time to do this today, and as well as thanking everyone for tuning in this morning, as well as the great team that put this together. As Gail mentioned, you can continue to follow us on whitehouse.gov, also whitehouse.gov/live. There are fact sheets, more information on the president's policy directive on development, and there should be a video on whitehouse.gov a little bit later. So until next time, thank you, everyone.